Lecture 8, First Manassas, or Bull Run.
Following the Upper South secession and the transfer of the seat of the Confederate government from Montgomery, Alabama, to Richmond, Virginia, both sides sought to mobilize men and resources and to plot their military strategies. This lecture will examine Union planning in the late spring and early summer of 1861. We will then move on to consider the background and the conduct and the consequences of the Battle of First Manassas, or Bull Run, the first major military engagement of the war. But let's start by looking at the task that the North faced in trying to come up with a strategy that would force the wayward states back into the Union. And the key actor in the early consideration of this question will be Winfield Scott. Winfield Scott was in Washington, D.C. He was presiding as General-in-Chief of the United States Armies over the initial Union attempt to come up with a strategy to mobilize resources, and in the process he also was advising Abraham Lincoln, trying to bring the new president along, a president who had virtually no military experience and hadn't read much about the military. Scott was trying to run things in a military sense on the one hand and to bring the new president along, bring him up to speed militarily on the other hand. Both sides, both Richmond and Washington, were concerned about maintaining the safety of the capital cities at this point. Jefferson Davis and his advisors were thinking about that in Richmond. And in Washington, there was great concern about the safety of the capital, and that started a pattern that would continue throughout the war. Congress always was worried about the safety of Washington, D.C., paid an inordinate amount of attention to it, really, and Lincoln, of course, had to be concerned about it as well. So that's going on. There's worry about the respective capitals and planning. In terms of overall strategy, I'll reiterate a point that I've made earlier, and that is the Confederacy had an easier task at this point. All it had to do was respond to whatever the North did. If the North, the United States, chose not to do anything, if it didn't invade the Confederacy would achieve its independence by default. It wouldn't have to fight for it at all. But the North, if it were going to reunite the Union, had to come up with a plan that would allow Union forces to strike into the South, defeat Confederate armies, and force the 11 seceding states to come back into the Union. Had to bring the Richmond government to its knees, in other words. And in the vortex of this planning in the North is Lieutenant General Winfield Scott. Scott is one of the great military figures in United States history, although he's not often thought of in those terms by students of the Civil War, because by the time of the war, he was a very old man. He was in his mid-70s, and he's often seen in caricature as someone who was well past his prime. That really isn't accurate. He had been in the Army a long time. Winfield Scott's service went all the way back to before the War of 1812. He'd been one of the great United States heroes in the War of 1812, an officer who had been innovative, who'd been a good leader in combat, and who had forged an exceptional record. He had towered over the military landscape of the Mexican War. He had conducted a campaign from Veracruz to Mexico City and captured the Mexican capital that ranks as one of the most brilliant campaigns in United States military history. The Duke of Wellington followed Scott's campaign very closely in Mexico and pronounced Scott to be the greatest soldier of the age. Scott also had had political ambitions. He was a Whig. He'd run as the Whig candidate for president in 1852. So he had been at the center of national affairs for many, many decades. And now he found himself, as I said before, the only soldier holding the rank that the sainted George Washington had held, found himself presiding over the early Union effort to begin this war successfully. In his mid-70s, as I said, an imposing man in his youth. He was 6'5" tall, affected very showy uniforms, impressed people tremendously who saw him in his prime. Among those who saw him was a young Ulysses S. Grant, who reminisced after the war about a time when Winfield Scott visited the cadets at West Point. Grant wrote this about Scott. He said, "With his commanding figure and his quite colossal size and showy uniform, I thought him the finest specimen of manhood my eyes had ever beheld." He was the man, said Grant, the most to be envied. Well, he didn't look like that anymore in 1861. He weighed about 350 pounds. He had to literally be winched up into the air. His poor horse would be led underneath him. Scott would be eased down onto his horse. And then he would ride, I hope not very far, for the animal's sake, and then would be lifted off, and then he would do his job. But that somewhat decrepit physical appearance, he suffered from dropsy, among many other ailments. That physical picture of Scott should not obscure the fact that his mind still worked extremely well. And what Winfield Scott did in April and early May of 1861 was apply his powerful intellect to the problem of how to defeat the Confederacy, and he came up with a long-range plan to win the war that, in effect, anticipated almost exactly how the war would be fought. And this is what Scott said the North needed to do. He envisioned first a powerful move down the Mississippi River. He wanted to gain control of the river, divide the Confederacy into two pieces. He envisioned doing this by having a naval flotilla work together with army forces on the Mississippi River and have them move down, supporting one another, taking one position after another, if the Confederates chose to resist, until finally the Mississippi would be in Union control and the Confederacy would be divided. At the same time that this movement down the Mississippi was taking place, Scott called for a blockade of the Confederate coastline. He wanted to seal the Confederate coast, deny the Confederacy war material that they would need to import from abroad, and prevent the Confederacy from shipping its goods, especially its cotton, out to foreign markets and getting the money that that cotton would yield that the Confederacy could then apply to its war effort. So strike down the Mississippi, divide the Confederacy, seal off the coastline. These elements of the plan, because they called for constricting the Confederacy, came to be called the Anaconda Plan. That's what the northern newspapers called it. The plans were printed in all the northern newspapers. The Confederates read them too. As Scott was formulating his strategy, the Confederates were reading about it in the newspapers. They knew what the North might be doing, but it didn't really matter. The proof would come in the execution. Scott had one more element to his plan. If striking down the river and sealing the coast was not enough to defeat the Confederacy, he said it would take a major invasion into the heartland of the Confederacy to finish off the South. He thought that invasion might take 2 to 3 years and as many as 300,000 men. So he's thinking on a very broad scale. Most people at the time were not. Scott understands that it's going to be a long war and that it might take hundreds of thousands of men. Remember, this at a time when the United States Army is about 15,000 strong. So Scott understands the magnitude of the task ahead of the North, and his Anaconda plan shows that. Now, except by underestimating by about half how many men it would actually take in the end, it took many more hundreds of thousands, and how many years it would take, Scott had formulated a plan that anticipated pretty much how the war would be played out. Scott understood that time was going to be a necessary ingredient. It was going to take a long time to bring all these volunteers into the Army, to train them, to prepare the fleets, to get everything ready to move down the Mississippi River. And he worried that Northern public opinion would not tolerate too much time going by. He understood how public opinion worked. The citizens behind the lines in the North, once the Confederate capital had been moved to Richmond, looked at the map and said, well, it's only 100 miles away from Washington. Why don't we just go take it? If we take Richmond, we'll end the war. And a drumbeat began behind the lines in the North of, let's move against Richmond, let's move on to Richmond, get our forces in the field, take the Confederate capital, let's end this war. Scott told Lincoln, and other military figures did as well, it's going to take longer than that. We can't rush our troops into the field. We have to take our time and build real armies. Scott's greatest worry was that political considerations, pressure from the civilian sector, would force the Lincoln government to move before the military was really in a good position to move. But we have this call for an on to Richmond campaign that really would remain for the rest of the war. Much of the North would, throughout the war, look at that little piece of ground between Virginia and Washington and just think that our forces should be able to move down and take the rebel capital, and there would be constant pressure for the United States government to do that. It began a preoccupation on the part of the Northern people with Virginia and Richmond and the Eastern Theater that would continue for the rest of the war. And it would, of course, help make Virginia the bloodiest battleground of the war. More of the great battles of the conflict would be fought in that strip of ground between the Potomac River and the James River than anywhere else. Well, at this point in the war, Lincoln was ready to try to satisfy the demands of the Northern public. He would be much more sophisticated about these things very quickly, but early on, Lincoln thought that it was probably possible to just move south and capture Richmond as well. He knew that the Union forces were green, but he knew that they were larger than the Confederate forces, which were also green. And he reasoned that since we have more green troops than the enemy has, why don't we let our larger number of green troops defeat their smaller number of green troops? If we can win a victory early in the war, thought Lincoln, we might be able to discourage the South. We might even be able to persuade them that their experiment in rebellion is going to fail. So Lincoln did not listen to Scott's advice here. He thought that it was possible to move more quickly than his principal military advisors did. Another soldier who agreed with Scott was a brigadier general named Irvin McDowell. Irvin McDowell commanded the largest United States force in the field. It was near Washington. He's the field commander. Scott is the overall general-in-chief at this point. McDowell agreed with Scott that his troops were not ready to engage in a campaign, that it would take more time to get them ready. But he, like Scott, was not going to be successful in these arguments. And the upshot was he was pushed into what became the campaign of First Manassas, or Bull Run. It's a battle with two names, and there are a number of those during the Civil War. We might as well touch on that now. The pattern in naming battles, if a battle has two names, almost invariably the North would have named it after some terrain feature in the vicinity. The South would have named it after a railroad crossroads or a town. In this instance, Manassas Junction is the railroad junction. There's not a town there, but the railroads come together there. That's the Confederate name. Bull Run is a local creek. And so the Federals used the terrain feature. Other examples of this are Antietam, the Union name for the battle in western Maryland, named after the creek. Sharpsburg is the Confederate name for that battle, named after the little local village. In Tennessee, there's the Battle of Murfreesboro or Stones River. Murfreesboro, the Confederate name, Stones River, the Union name, and there are many other examples. This is the first one, Manassas or Bull Run, and let's turn now to that campaign, the first large military campaign of the war. It pitted four forces against one another in Virginia, two Confederate, two Union, and the strategic picture was this. The largest Union army under Irvin McDowell was just a few miles outside Washington, about 35,000 men. McDowell had never commanded troops in the field. He was a former staff officer, no field experience, and here he is commanding the largest army in United States history. No one had ever commanded an army, no one else, as large as the one that Irvin McDowell was commanding. He'd taught tactics at West Point. He was a friend of Secretary of the Treasury Salmon P. Chase, which certainly didn't hurt him in his search for a command early in the war. It was nice to have friends in powerful places. He wasn't known for much, but he was known as a man who could certainly hold his own at the table. There's one famous anecdote of a staff officer bringing in a watermelon, sort of triumphantly bringing it into camp and putting it down on the table, and the officers gathering around hoping to get a piece, and McDowell sat down, pulled out a knife, and ate the entire melon, including the seeds and rind in front of his somewhat astonished staffers. He's known somewhat as an eater. He's not really known as an officer who might bring great success in the field. So he's the largest Union army in this theater. The second Union force consisted of about 18,000 men in the lower Shenandoah Valley, commanded by another veteran of the War of 1812 named Robert Patterson. 20 miles from McDowell near Manassas Junction was Gustav Tutom Beauregard, whom we have seen before. He commanded the principal Southern force of about 20,000, men. Beauregard was also a former staff officer. He very briefly had been superintendent at West Point on the eve of the war. Very, very briefly. His tenure lasted less than a week. And here he was commanding the largest Confederate force in the field. He was a Louisiana Creole, not a Cajun, but a Creole, had something of a Napoleonic complex, a very vain man. He dyed his hair. His early war pictures, his hair is nice and dark. The chemicals he used to do that ceased to come in through the blockade later in the war, and his hair turned its natural color, which was gray at that point. He's not a brilliant general, but on the whole, he's a very capable one. The other Confederate on the board was Joseph Eggleston Johnston, who had about 12,000 Confederates opposite Patterson in the Lower Valley. So you have McDowell and Beauregard facing each other, and you have Patterson, and Joseph Johnston. Johnston was a Virginian, a classmate of Lee's at West Point, and a man we will see again and again in the course of our study of the Civil War. He has quite a substantial reputation as a Civil War commander, one that I think is probably not deserved, as will become clear as we go through the course. I don't have a very high opinion of Johnston as a soldier. He had had a distinguished career in the old army, that is the pre-war army, had fought well and gallantly in Mexico and had been wounded there. Beauregard and Johnston have a great advantage over their federal opponents here because they have a rail link, and I've mentioned this before, the Manassas Gap Railroad connects their two forces, so the Confederates enjoy interior lines, interior strategic lines here that will allow them to reinforce one another more easily than their federal opponents. McDowell's plan was a good one, although it was probably too complicated for his largely untrained army. His troops and officers, men used to dealing with much smaller bodies of men. He wanted to keep Patterson to the task of looking after Johnston in the valley. He told Patterson, "You hold Johnston in the valley, and I will deal with the force under Beauregard. So don't let Johnston leave the Shenandoah Valley." He planned to avoid a direct attack. We've seen that most people knew this was the case. His plan was to march against Beauregard and not attack him directly, but march against him and turn the southern left flank. So as he faces Beauregard, he will hold his attention in front and then try a flanking maneuver against the Confederate left. Interestingly, Beauregard had the same plan. He planned, when coming in contact with the Federals, to hold in front and try to turn McDowell's left. Both officers essentially hoping to do the same thing. There's no surprise involved here. McDowell's army left Washington on July 16th and moved very slowly to the west. Confederates knew immediately what was going on. They had lots of intelligence coming in from local people friendly to them and so forth. The key breakdown on the Union side came early when General Patterson failed to engage Johnston and hold him in the valley, and Johnston began to shift his army by rail to Manassas Junction to link up with Beauregard. Also, some smaller units elsewhere in Virginia began to march toward Beauregard. By July 20th, the Confederates had utilized their interior lines to bring together a formidable force near Manassas Junction. While the Confederates concentrated there, McDowell moved forward, very sedately again. Remember, it's going to take him several days to get from Washington to Manassas Junction. It's a matter of just a few more than 20 miles. On July 21, 1861, McDowell was in position to implement his plan for a turning movement against the southern left. And let's pick up the battle itself now here. It's July 21st, 1861. Early that morning, 12,000 Federals crossed Bull Run, and they swung up around the Confederate left flank, moving to get into position to launch a significant blow. Joe Johnston was in command on the Confederate side by this point because his command predated. He was the same rank as Beauregard, but his date of command was earlier than Beauregard, so Johnston is in overall command. They realize that the Federals are applying pressure in their front, and they're aware also that there are some Federals moving around to their left. Before the Confederates could inaugurate their own flanking movement against the Union Army, the Federals were in position and launched their attacks against the Confederate left flank. And the attacks went well in the beginning. They pushed the Confederates back to the south and confronted the Confederates with a crisis. Johnston and Beauregard responded by utilizing their tactical interior lines and shifting strength from their right flank to their left flank to try to meet the threat mounted by the Federals in that direction. And the battle came to center on a high knob called Henry House Hill. The Confederates held it. It's right near the Warrenton Turnpike. The Federals were attacking it, and the battle swayed back and forth. A key stand was made on Henry House Hill by a Virginia brigade commanded by Thomas Jonathan Jackson, a former teacher at the Virginia Military Institute, a very dour man. We'll talk more about him later. But Jackson and his Virginians made a stand on Henry House Hill. A South Carolina officer named Barnard B. at one point pointed to the Virginians and urged his men to do as they were doing. He said, "There stands Jackson like a stone wall. Rally on the Virginians." Later, there was some dispute about what B. actually meant by that. Some said that he was being derisive in saying, "There stands Jackson like a stone wall." He thought Jackson should have been moving, not standing like a stone wall. We can't be certain what he meant, but the point was Jackson was making a stand. It was a nickname that would stick to him. He would be Stonewall Jackson ever after, and everybody interpreted it as a positive nickname, whether that's how Barnard B. Meant it or not. B. was would be dead very shortly, so no one could interview him about what he had meant precisely. But Jackson did hold, he and his troops. For more than 2 hours, the fighting raged on Henry House Hill. There was a widow named Judith Carter Henry, who lived on that hill on the top of it in her house. She fell victim to a cannonball that crashed into her bedroom, sent splinters into her face and stomach, and nearly severed one of her feet. She held on in great pain until late in the afternoon, when she finally died of her multiple wounds. Outside her house, her son hugged the ground, worried about his mother, raising himself up occasionally to cry out, "They have killed my mother." About 4 p.m., Southern reinforcements, the last of Joseph Johnston's troops from the valley, marched onto the field, marched into the critical sector of the field, and turned the tide. It's late in the day. These troops were the crucial component in setting in motion a major Union retreat. The Confederates raised the rebel yell for one of the first times, if not the first time in the war. It's an interesting aspect of the war that Union and Confederate soldiers seemed to yell differently. Union soldiers yelled in a more disciplined way. They tended to chant in a sort of low voice, "Huzzah," as they went into battle. It sounds odd, but that's what they did. The Confederates, in contrast, had a much more free-form way of yelling. They would just sort of whoop and holler in a loud, high cry that some people liken to a fox hunter's cry. I think that says something about the respective civilizations. I'm not sure what, but it must say something. At any rate, the rebel yell floated across the battlefield for one of the first times of the war, and the Confederates slowly gained momentum until they had the Union soldiers in full retreat. It was hot on that July 21st. The troops on both sides were hungry, and they were thirsty, and they were green, and once their momentum had been stopped and then reversed, the Federal soldiers very rapidly made their way away from the battlefield. Orderly retreats are even a problem with veteran troops. With green troops, they very quickly disintegrate into a rout, and that's what happened here. As the Union troops made their way away from the battlefield, they ran into a large number of civilians. Civilians had come out from Washington to watch what they thought was going to be the one great battle of the war. They thought they'd come out and see the conflict resolved at Manassas. Whichever side would win the war. They'd spread out picnic lunches. They had a blanket spread out and hampers with food and carriages with parasols. Young children were scampering around the hills near the battlefield. And now in the afternoon, this group of civilians saw this mass, this disorganized mass of Union soldiers coming toward them, and the whole group became intermingled and made their way back to Washington. There was a congressman from New York, a man named Alfred Ely, who'd come out to watch the battle. He was captured by the Confederates in the course of the retreat, roughly handled by some South Carolinians, and soon on his way to a prison in Richmond. The Federal Army reached the Washington defenses late that night, having covered in a few hours the same distance it had taken them several days to cover going the other way. By the end of the next day, order had been restored to much of McDowell's force, and Washington really wasn't in danger. If there was any moment when the Confederates really could have exploited this victory, it was on the afternoon of July 21st, but the Confederate Army was just about as disorganized in victory as the Union Army was in defeat. Jefferson Davis had ridden out to the field late in the day, president of the Confederacy. He had urged a pursuit. Stonewall Jackson had hoped to be able to pursue, but Joseph Johnston said, no, darkness is coming. We are very much confused. Our units intermingled with one another. We'll have to wait and reassess the situation tomorrow. Whether or not there was a real opportunity is up in the air. The point is Johnston did not try to push it, and the Federal Army escaped and gathered itself in Washington and was something like an effective force by the next day. Whatever opportunity there had been was gone. Now let's look at the battle as representative of other Civil War battles. Of the war, of the many battles in the war, this one showed several things that we'll see again and again. One is the attempt to avoid a frontal assault. As we've said, both sides tried to get around the other side's flank. It showed the side with interior lines making good use of that feature, both strategically on the Confederate side and then tactically on the Confederate side as well, reinforcing one part of their line from another. We will see those again and again. We'll see as well that when an army or a piece of an army was driven from the field, it often had the resiliency to gather itself and put up a stand and not be utterly destroyed. The Union Army showed this at Manassas, and we'll see it again and again during the war. At Chancellorsville, for example, Stonewall Jackson's flank attack utterly routed one entire Union corps, but the rest of the army simply pulled itself into a position, the rest of the Union Army, to resist Jackson's attack. At Chickamauga, a third of the entire Federal Army was driven from the field en route, but the rest managed to pull itself together and stave off a terrible defeat. So these are things that are anticipated at Manassas that we'll see again and again in the war. Let's talk just a minute in closing here about the results of the battle. First, the casualties. The casualties by later Civil War standards were not high, really quite modest. It would be a mid-sized battle later in the war. About 18,000 men on each side actually got into the fight. The Federals lost 1,500 killed and wounded and another 1,200 missing. Most of those missing were captured, although some may have been mortally wounded and just crawled off and died or something, but most captured. The South lost about 2,000 men. So 2,000 on the Confederate side, 2,700 on the Federal side. Later in the war, as I said, this would be considered a mid-sized battle or even a modest-sized battle. But here in July of 1861, it's an enormous battle, the biggest battle in United States history, with far more casualties than any other battle had. It seemed like a ghastly bloodletting to the people at the time. The South, of course, took heart from the Battle of First Manassas. They thought they were well on their way to winning the war. Morale in the North, civilian morale, was depressed. It seemed that the war now was going to drag on, and it actually made most people in the North more resolute, determined to make whatever sacrifices would be necessary to win the war. For many Confederates, it seemed that the notion that one Southerner could whip two or three Yankees or however many Yankees might be true. They didn't pay attention to the fine details that they'd actually been losing the battle until late in the contest when the tide turned. There has been some speculation by scholars that this early defeat at Manassas actually had a tremendous long-term psychological impact on the Union Army in the East, that the Union Army for many, many months or even years after this expected to be defeated when they went up against the Confederates, that there really was a sort of First Manassas syndrome in the Northern Army. That's very hard either to prove or disprove, but I offer it to you as something that some scholars have thought existed after this battle. Whether or not that's true, it was clear to everyone in the North that stamping out the rebellion was not going to be a one-battle affair, which is what many people had thought before the Battle of First Manassas. Now, there were not going to be any more big battles in Virginia in 1861. This was going to be the biggest one, the only big one for the whole year in Virginia. And so the effects of Manassas lingered. The impressions from the battle held on for a long time. That is, impressions of Confederate success and of Union failure would hold on for a long time after the last soldiers had left what were called the rolling plains of Manassas at the time. We're going to leave the battlefield with this lecture, and we're going to move briefly to a consideration of the Great Border in our next lecture and see how Lincoln's administration coped with a political rather than a military problem.